Karen Conti Show. That has a nice ring to it, doesn't it? And if you haven't tuned in the last couple weeks, we have a change. Brian Noonan is on from 3 to 7, and I am on from 7 to 9. So we're going to have 2 hours to talk about legal topics, non-legal topics, and also take your calls. From 8 o'clock to 9 o'clock, I'll be taking all of your legal calls on any topic you might have, whether it's divorce or criminal, contract, consumer fraud, anything that you have. I'll try to steer you in the right direction or give you an answer. I'll give you the numbers now, but we're not going to probably get around to them till the 8 o'clock hour, and the number is 312-981-7200, and the text is the same, 312-981-7200. We've got a very interesting show. We're going to be talking to an expert about the 13 children in California, the parents and the children from both perspectives, what went wrong here. And then about 7:30, we'll be talking about narcissism, a very interesting topic. I'll bet that everybody out in the listening audience knows at least one narcissist who you're related to, who you work for, maybe who you're married to. And what is narcissism? Why is it a diagnosis? Why do people become a narcissist? And what and how do you act around a narcissist? And how do you get have a good relationship with someone who is one? But anyway, I want to introduce my first guest. Her name is Megan Lerner, and Megan Lerner is a social worker and a clinical coordinator at the Lurie Children Trauma Treatment Service at the Lurie Chicago Hospital, one of the top pediatric providers in the city. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
Here we go. Hi. So obviously we have all looked, watched this train wreck of a case of the 13 children, the Turpin family out of Paris, California, where the parents of these 13 children, ages somewhere between 2 and 29, were in a house, basically imprisoned in a way, and yeah, horribly mistreated from a standpoint of medical care, food, and the basic teachings for children. And you've watched this, and I guess I want to know, what kind of parents do this to their children? What do we know about them, and what can we say about who they are?
I mean, I think having never met, obviously, the Turpin family, I can't necessarily speak very articulately to what they actually have or are diagnosed with, but I think I can sort of postulate on some of the ideas. I think there is a history, as we've seen in the course of time, of the parents having their own abuse history, and not all people, I want to be very clear, that have a history of abuse go on to become abusers, but I do think that that can increase, and research sort of supports that it can increase the propensity for perpetuating abuse. And then I also know that there's been some discussion about the parents potentially being and participating in some pretty significant and constrictive religious practices that could have also brought to light some of this. I don't think we 100% understand why people do these things, but I think that ultimately the impact is what is going to be the real issue as we sort of move forward.
Now, when it comes to parents like this, are they people who at some point are going to say, wow, I did something wrong, I think I shouldn't have done this, the children are harmed, or are they going to perpetually think that what they did was proper parenting?
I hope that for the children's sake, they are able one day to accept responsibility for what they've done, because we know that the outcomes for the children's own health and wellness will be significantly improved if the parents can do that. I don't know that it's possible, because I don't know what is driving the parents' behavior.
Now, Megan, in your job with Lurie Children's Trauma Treatment and Service, What kind of kids do you see? What kind of abuse do you see? I mean, this is kind of at the extreme, I would imagine.
Absolutely. I think this is definitely an extreme, and fortunately it is an extreme given all of the things that, you know, have been sort of coming out in the media over time. We see a variety of different chief complaints and reasons for seeking service on our team. We're a multidisciplinary team. We have psychiatrists, we have psychologists, we have clinical social workers, and we also have trainees who work to help various forms of abuse. So we see physical abuse, sexual abuse. Because we are a hospital, we see medical trauma, which isn't necessarily intentional trauma, but kids going through chronic medical conditions and medical procedures can experience trauma as a result. We do see some of what this would be considered, which we would call complex trauma, which is multiple different types of trauma over the course of a significant period of time during development. And we see things from car accidents to natural disaster experiences, things like
and
that.
And I would imagine community violence is a big one as well.
Community violence is one of our biggest ones, which is one of the things that we're starting a really amazing and very exciting program surrounding.
Yeah. So let's take it from the children's standpoint. The children, some of them of whom are not children, they're
right.
adult children, you have this group of 13. What is it that the therapist and the psychiatrist and the psychologist, what are they doing generally at this point in time?
At this point in time, I think it's a lot about assessment and about figuring out sort of where everyone is at and what the needs are. Having experienced what we call complex trauma, meaning trauma that started at the early on in childhood and then has sort of continued throughout the course of large developmental periods of time, this can have a dramatic impact not only on the kid's emotional well-being, but also on their physical well-being. And so I think you start first and foremost with the most critical experiences. So are there medical conditions that need immediate treatment? Are there thoughts of suicide or thoughts of homicide or things that are putting people's safety at immediate risk? And then I think from there, they're looking at, okay, how do we meet the needs over a longer term? You can't actually be diagnosed with post-traumatic stress disorder or PTSD, which is what I think everybody is thinking that these children probably have. Immediately, there is a period of time after the abuse stops where that is something that you would be calling an acute stress disorder if you're using the medical diagnostic manual, because there is this period where with abuse, not everybody that experiences a trauma, whether it is abuse or not, automatically has trauma symptoms. Now, I would be remiss to say that there's probably not a kid in this family that isn't experiencing trauma symptoms, given the chronicity and the intensity of what we're sort of hearing. But the child brain is a really resilient concept, and there is the potential for healing within the child brain without necessarily a ton of intervention.
We're talking to Megan Lerner from Lurie Children's Hospital, and we're talking about the horrible case of the 13 children found in Paris, California, on WGN. Are they trying to keep these children together? If there's two or three children, that might be something easy. But when you have 13 children with a span of ages, I would imagine that finding foster care would be very difficult.
And I would imagine also the complex needs of the children are probably pretty ranging. One of the things that we know that kids who have experienced chronic abuse and kids who have experienced abuse within that 0 to 5, 0 to 6 range, especially, can really demonstrate significant physiological changes and medical conditions. So I would, my educated guess would be that each of those kids has some pretty significant and special needs in some capacity.
We clearly have malnutrition.
Sure.
I mean, we had an adult child who was 80-something pounds. So we know that those children are now being fed and hopefully on a program to get them healthy that way. We also know that their medical needs were, I would say, to say they're neglected is an understatement.
Sure.
Because some of them probably never saw a doctor. They didn't know how to brush their teeth. They didn't know what medicine was. So
yes.
I would assume that there are going to be ongoing physical examinations. But you told me something interesting off the microphone that I asked you the question about if a child is neglected in the first, say, six months to maybe 2 years of their lives, how does that affect them? Because they would never remember that. They would
right.
never remember that mom wasn't there or that they didn't get their feedings regularly. So is there some idea from all this research that has been done as to whether or not there is some long-term effect for that kind of neglect?
Absolutely. There's a lot of great research being done about that 0 to 5 community. One of the things that we know, and when I keep talking about these physiological changes, is we know that kids who live in orphanages, who have a strict feeding schedule and a strict changing schedule and limited human interaction, their brains actually do not develop to the same size
wow.
as children who are getting regular care from their parents. And that's a study that Bruce Perry, who is a medical doctor and one of the leading voices out there about that early childhood neglect and abuse discusses pretty frequently. I think, yes, you don't have the traditional, and this is one of the things we also talked about. I don't think you have the traditional memories of I wasn't getting fed when I want to, but you're getting reinforcement from the world that the people that are supposed to keep me safe and take care of me aren't doing that. And even if I express that I have a need, the adults in the world aren't meeting that need. And so then you learn to distrust the world.
Interesting. Very, very interesting. Megan Lerner, we're going to take a break here. And if you have any comments or questions on this issue or any issue relating to child abuse and neglect, 312-981-7200. You're listening to The Karen Conti Show. Welcome back. We're talking to Megan Lerner about child abuse and neglect. And I guess this issue of these children not being, into this world, they haven't really been exposed to things. They haven't been exposed to simple things. Like, I think one of them was asked, do you something about a police officer, and they didn't know what a police officer was, which reminds me of that movie and the book that I read called Room. Mm-hmm. Did you happen to read that book?
I did read the book. I did see the movie.
And if anyone out there doesn't know what that is, it's about a woman who's actually kept captive by an evil man, and she gives birth in this room, and she keeps her child in the room to maybe 6, 7, 8 years old, and then finally gets released. That's a spoiler alert. But it's interesting because the remaining part of the movie talks about the development of a child who's never been exposed to anything real outside of this single room. And it reminds me of what these kids are going to be up against. Tell me, what is the process of trying to integrate the children into the real world?
That is a very complex question.
Yeah.
I think ultimately the key piece is really trying to figure out where each of the children are at and then meeting them where their children are at accordingly, right? So having and building a structure around the children that teaches them that the world is a safe place and that the world isn't as scary as they probably were conditioned to believe over the course of time in sort of being in that house. I think the other thing that's important to remember is that these kids were, yes, locked in the house, but they were locked in the house, but then they also were taken out. We see all these pictures of them at Disney World, and we see pictures of them in Las Vegas. You know, I think with abuse and with interfamilial abuse, there is an extra level of complexity because we are taught intrinsically that we are supposed to love our parents. So I believe that there's a hard road ahead of these kids because they're going to have to sort of learn to manage the good memories that they have with their parents with the reality of the fact that their parents weren't people that could keep them safe and take care of them.
And it's a fascinating phenomenon. Even in the family law where I practice, you do see children who have been abused by their parents and they still love them dearly and they still want a relationship with them. However, in this case, I saw this past week that there was an order of protection entered against the parents for a 3-year period, which doesn't mean it necessarily is lifted. It means that it would have to be renewed in 3 years, that the parents have no contact whatsoever with those children. I don't know that the defense attorney objected. I think he was on board to say it probably protects both parties to this issue. Is there a point in time that you could ever imagine? I know you're looking into a
crystal ball.
Yeah. But is it possible that these children should, from a therapeutic standpoint, see their parents again for one reason or another, to either hold them accountable or to see them and talk to them? What would be your thought on that?
I think ultimately if the parents aren't going to accept responsibility for what they did, that may be tricky, an idea of reunification. Reunification in and of itself is sort of its own sect in the mental health world, and people are doing this job sort of independently of trauma-focused work, which is what we're doing at Lurie. So I would say I'm not an expert in reunification for sure, but I would say when thinking about the families that I've worked with where a parent has been a perpetrator or a familial contact has been part of the perpetration of victimization against a kid, one of the things that we really try to do is try to not bring that other person in until the victim feels an increased sense of control. I think one of the things that abuse does sort of knowingly, and one of the things that all of my patients really speak to me about, is that loss of control that happens. And this is sort of an extra layer because it's a loss of control at a time when you don't have a lot of control anyway because you're a child and you look to your parents to help teach you how to function in the world and to say, this is good and this is bad. And their parents sort of did the exact opposite of that.
If you have any comments or questions for Megan or for me, 312-981-7200 or text to the same number. We have a texter from the 630 who asks, what protections are there in the state of Illinois to prevent this kind of thing from happening here? Can you speak to that? And again, and also within the same topic is, if you see something, if you, you know, it seems to me and seems to everybody that something should have been noticed and reported here, and maybe it was, and we don't know that.
Sure.
But, you know, along those terms, who should have been seeing this, and what can a person do if they see something that's unusual?
I think the difference, and I can really only speak to the state of Illinois, right? Just that is where I'm practicing. So in the state of Illinois, the thing that we have that sort of takes care of all children is the Department of Children and Family Services, or DCFS. They have a 1-800 number, and it's 1-800-25-ABUSE. Anybody can call with any concern at any time. You can also call and ask for what's called a child welfare check, which is basically requesting that somebody go out and talk with the family and offer them potential services because you have a concern. The thing about that is that it is a voluntary program, and so if the family chooses not to engage in that and the DCFS worker does not see anything that's concerning in the doorway, there's really nothing they can do.
But it's a step. It's something that
absolutely
you can do.
And then you can also always call 911. You can always call 311. And you can ask the police to go and do a welfare check as well.
And they're probably a little more aggressive in going in than
they
the DCFS.
They do not have the same rules as DCFS. No.
So just really bullet point. What are the things that somebody, an outsider, a neighbor, a teacher, maybe a parent of a child, who's playing with the child who has some issues. What would you see in someone who is neglected or abused?
So one of the things that they really talk about in this case is that when the children were going to school, they were very dirty. They smelled. They were not well cared for. I think especially in young children, if you're seeing that and it's becoming sort of a common or an everyday thing or is something that the kid is getting teased about, that's certainly a red flag. If you see a kid who sort of looks withdrawn or despondent or is particularly tired, that can be a red flag. The problem is that everything that I'm currently describing can also just be a kid.
Right.
Right?
A teenager with some hygiene issues.
Oh my gosh, how many times do I sit in my office and say, we have to take a shower. Deodorant is our friend. Right? Like, I think that there is some, like, people are hoping that there is like some gold star that these people will wear and we can just see and intervene immediately. And that's just not a realistic expectation. My goal, my gut, my report, and when I'm teaching people how to do this work, I'm saying if you're concerned, try to figure out what the concern is, and if it feels like a legitimate concern, it's always better to overcall than undercall.
Megan, we're talking about the case of the 13 children in California, but as I'm talking, just real briefly, and we're going to maybe come back in a little bit, but just can you give me just a brief insight as to what you think in the Nassar sentencing case when you had 160 young women come and talk? Was that a good thing for them from your standpoint, from knowing what abusers go through? Is this something that's positive for them?
Absolutely. When we do all sorts of interventions at the hospital, one of the main frameworks we work for is called trauma-focused cognitive behavioral therapy. And the big punch in TFCBT, as they call it, is doing what's called a trauma narrative, which is really helping the victim tell their story in a way that puts the power back to them. And I have had the privilege of participating in that experience with many different types of trauma and many different patients, and every single time every one of my patients has said, I really hated when you made me do that, but it really helped.
And I've been reading about how the girls and women were actually formulating their victim impact statements and what they wanted to do, and they wanted to tell the world, they wanted to tell others, they wanted to tell the judge, they wanted to confront their perpetrators. So there were multiple reasons for them doing it, and they seemed like, although obviously very heart-wrenching, very positive after it was over.
And for so long, those poor girls were suffering. silenced, right? They were telling people and people weren't believing them. This man who gets the sort of implicit trust we give doctors, right? We assume that when we go to a doctor, that's a safe person. We teach our children, you don't have to worry. We're going to the doctor. The doctor's allowed to look at you in your private areas. The doctor is a safe place to go to be around those things. And, you know, some of the testimony reported that he was doing this in front of people's parents.
Absolutely.
So I think that it probably was a very empowering experience. And I think as just an audience member, it was a very empowering thing to watch.
Megan Lerner, I want to thank you for joining us. Our time just flew. Megan Lerner's with Lurie Children's Trauma Treatment Service. If anyone wants to get a hold of you, how would they contact you?
So the best way to get a hold of me is probably going through the hospital as a whole. And you can reach out to Lurie Children's Hospital. The main number is 312-227-4000, and that would probably be the best way to go about kind of getting connected to us and to the wonderful service and the wonderful team that I'm just so lucky to be a part of.
They do great work. Megan Lerner, thank you very much, and we wish those children the best. I'm sure everyone else does. You're listening to WGN on the Karen Conti Show.
You're so vain.
Narcissism. You know, I wish it were all about me, but I guess it isn't. I guess we have to talk about other people. Narcissism, it's a term that we have heard quite a bit about this past year in relation to sexual harassers, celebrities, and once in a while about certain presidents. But I don't know. I don't know that people really understand what narcissism is. And with us in the studio tonight to explain it is Dr. Gorgashan. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Dr. Gorgashan is a psychiatrist and a psychoanalyst who has had a clinical practice here in Chicago for over three decades. She also heads up a consulting firm that brings analysis of psychological issues to businesses, law firms, and political campaigns. She's a regular speaker and a regular writer for CNN, New York Times, and Wall Street Journal. Thank you for joining us. You're so qualified to talk about this fascinating issue. Narcissism. Now, we had You're So Vain, right?
Right. Lead-in.
Is this about vanity? Is this about looking in the mirror and checking your lipstick every 5 minutes?
Well, it's a very complicated issue. Narcissism is not necessarily a negative. And I think I want to explain that to people so they understand none of us could get out of the house and tuck our shirts in and brush our teeth and maybe put on a little makeup if we didn't have some healthy narcissism. There's a spectrum, like with any other part of our human psychology, there's a spectrum from healthy to pathological with narcissism. So healthy narcissism is what makes us feel like a valuable person, gives us vitality, gives us a sense that we have a place in the world and we can do things. And it's a sense of a strong self that's effective. At the other end of the spectrum is pathological forms of narcissism, narcissistic personality disorder, which really lead to disturbed relationships.
Now, let's just give some very quick bullet points of what, and I'm going to be talking not about the good narcissist. I'm going to be talking about the end of the spectrum where a person has that sort of personality disorder. What are the things that what kind of traits would you see in a person who would deem to be a narcissist?
Well, it's all about them, just like the song says. It's everything comes back to them. So they're usually hypersensitive to criticism. They are interested in how they appear, not necessarily how they look in terms of physical appearance, although that can be important to some, but what kind of feedback they're getting from other people. Are they popular? Are they loved? Are they admired? And there's a constant search for an assessment of whether they're getting feedback like that. Some narcissists are the guys who have to show off and say, hey, I got a guy who gives me a deal. The guy knows my name in the parking lot, in the restaurant. You know, they have to create a sense of being the big man around town.
A little bit of bragging.
Being important.
Yeah.
Being always saying how, conveying that they're in the know, they know people, they are there's special connections. Something's very special about
it. And, Doctor, this is, you know, again, I'm simplifying a little bit, and that's my job to simplify. But this isn't because they're full of themselves necessarily. It's because they're lacking in some sort of sense of self, and in to make up for that feeling, they're kind of over asserting themselves as being important.
Well, that's our general, you know, I'm not talking about any particular individual,
no.
But our general sense is that the more empty someone is inside, the more they have to compensate, more inadequate they feel, the more they have to build themselves up by bragging or showing off wealth or achievements and talking about themselves. If you're really a very accomplished, secure person, you don't have to make a big deal about it.
Right.
People will find out that you're capable and smart. You don't have to advertise it all the time.
And it's better that way, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
From a social standpoint.
Yes.
So can a narcissist, and I'm going to talk maybe a little bit later about how you become a narcissist, but can you be successful in the business world if you're a narcissist?
Oh, absolutely. In fact, again, I want to emphasize that it's not all negative. There is a need to, if you're a successful person, there's a part of you that has to think, I've got something to offer. There's something special about me. I don't think there's a president of the United States that doesn't have some what we call narcissistic traits or features. To think you could do a job like that, you have to think, you have to believe in yourself pretty strongly.
Right.
And most successful people in business have a degree of narcissism that gives them strength and drive and an ability to say, I'm the guy or the woman who can do this. However, it has to be tempered with, and this is the key thing, an awareness that there are other human beings on earth and that your behavior affects other people. And if you don't have the ability to check yourself and say, wait a minute, this is what I want, this is what I think needs to be done, but if I do this, my actions will hurt somebody. That's where you get into the dangerous realm.
Now, let's just say, I'm going to talk about the extreme, not the positive part of this. The positive part where narcissism becomes a problem in, say, relationships or in a business setting. If you sense that your boss is like this, he's always sensitive to criticism and he's very defensive and he's always telling you how important he is, this could create problems in the workplace, or if a fellow employee has
sure,
those same
absolutely.
Traits. What are some very basic bullet points that you would advise somebody how to deal with somebody with those traits?
Well, try not to humiliate them. Try
yeah.
to avoid, don't take them on in their own game. Try to avoid, because if they're sensitive to injury, if they are made to feel small or less, they're going to attack. So try to be careful about how you approach them and don't expose them unnecessarily. It is okay to say, hey, you know, let me remind you there's somebody else in the room, or that if you do that, that's going to hurt somebody. That's going to hurt me. Take the time to fill in the blank that they can't fill in, which is my actions have impact on other human beings. Many of narcissists cannot really pay attention to the fact that there are other people there. They don't, they're so wrapped up in their own world. So you can remind somebody, hello, I'm here, the world is here, your employees are here, let's take a moment to think about how they're going to feel.
Now, Doctor, in my world where I do practice in the family law area, I believe that I see, again, I'm not a professional in that area, but I believe that I see a lot of parties that are getting divorced that have narcissistic traits in the negative
mm-hmm.
sense. In my view, in my opinion, in my experience, it seems that those kinds of traits don't really make for a good relationship. And so if you are with a narcissist, and narcissists can be very charming, they
right.
can be very
Absolutely.
Successful, they can be very generous, and then when you get down to it and you see that they're kind of all about themselves, and that becomes a problem in a relationship. So, I mean, can a narcissist sustain a good relationship?
Again, it's not all or nothing. So you can try. If you're in a relationship with a narcissist, try to remind them that it is not all about them. Have a conversation and say, you know what, I know that's what you want, but I need you to pay attention to the fact that I'm actually here with a different perspective. You can try to educate them. Don't assume they're not teachable or trainable. in family law, I imagine you run into an awful lot of angry narcissists.
Yes.
And one of the things that is problematic with narcissism, both in the healthier forms and in the pathological ones, is that there's something we call a narcissistic injury, which is if your self-esteem is hurt, if you're made to feel small or humiliated, all of us, but especially people who are on the down the spectrum of narcissism, react with injury and then rage. So I suspect in the family law courts, you see a lot of enraged people who are may have been functioning at a much better level before relation in terms of relationships before their wife or husband said, I want a divorce. That's such an injury to their sense of self, their sense of adequacy and safety, personal.
It's rejection in the ultimate sense.
Absolutely.
And in the public sense, because it's a publicly filed document.
Right.
And part of what family lawyers do necessarily, unfortunately, is to say negative things, saying, I represent the mother, I say the mother is a fit parent, and sometimes you don't say the father is a fit parent,
right.
You know, which
right.
is the way that the strategy goes, but it doesn't really bode well for a person who has a sensitive ego.
Right. That's right.
We're talking to Dr. Gorgachan about narcissism. If you have any questions, or maybe you know somebody who's a narcissist and you have a question on how to deal with them, give us a call here at 312-981-7200. And remember, at the top of the hour, 8 o'clock, I'm going to be taking all of your calls on any legal topic whatsoever. 312-981-7200. You're listening to WGN. Karen Conti Show. Remember, I'm taking your calls, 312-981-7200, on any legal topic. I'm a practicing lawyer. I've practiced in a lot of different areas, and I can probably help guide you no matter what your question is. So please feel free to either call in or text us. Also, I wanted to mention that if you want to keep up with the Karen Conti Show, perhaps what we are going to be talking about on a Sunday, or if you want to get access to my This Day in Legal History, which I post on a daily basis, which is a little historical fact that happened on the day that has to relate to legal topics of all types, like me on Facebook. It's the Karen Conti Show on Facebook. Just like me, and you'll have access to that. Let's get back to our guest, Dr. Gorgachan, who is a psychiatrist and a psychoanalyst, who is talking a little bit about narcissism. Now, there is a term that I have heard lately called pathological narcissism, which seems to me to be the extreme narcissist. And what are the qualities of a person who's a pathological narcissist?
Well, pathological narcissism is a term that is you've heard a lot about recently. It's not a medical term, so it doesn't have a specific medical definition. But what people are talking about there is the extreme of the spectrum. And one of the key features is a lack of empathy, where somebody with pathological narcissism cannot get his mind around or her mind around the fact that there is another person there with a different experience who is impacted by his or her behaviors, and that there are other people in the world. It's like they're living in a bubble that is all about them, and they can be extremely, extremely hurtful.
And is it fair to say, too, that they almost get some pleasure out of it, hurting people? And that's what I've heard it being described.
I wouldn't say that.
Okay.
Not necessarily. That's a different. It's not possible overlap, but there's not necessarily pleasure about hurting people. They just don't really know that there are other people there. And if you say, hey, you know what? What you're doing is going to be hurtful to somebody, they're likely to say, you know what? I don't really care because I need to do this. There's a ruthlessness. It's a ruthlessness, but not a pleasure particularly.
Dr. Gorgachan, when you part of what you do now, you've got a business where you go and you go into businesses and you consult with them about psychological issues. And I'm reminded of that show, what's it called, Billions?
Yes, Billions.
Which Jerry, my husband, makes me watch. I'm not a huge fan of the show, but it is interesting because in the show, this guy, who's a billionaire and a massive, you know, business success, has a full-time psychologist who works in the company who basically coaches the various players on how to do their job, how to deal with whatever psychological issues are present. Is that somewhat what you do?
Yes, it is. I actually have she's a Wendy Rose. She's a performance coach, and she's a psychiatrist, I think, and a psychoanalyst too, the character. And what she does is similar to what I do of try to help people at the moment of making a business decision understand the deeper psychological issues that are affecting their behavior. So
give me a for instance. Would it be, hiring is one. Would hiring be an issue that you would help with? And I have my own business, and when I hire people, I just find that I'm at a loss because you can look at a resume, you can interview somebody, you can check all the references, but the bottom line is I don't know how responsive they'll be to my clients. I don't know how dedicated they'll be to the issues, how empathetic they might be to situations, and how they might work with others. I have no way of gauging that, but I would imagine a psychologist like you might have a better insight.
Well, I hope I do. I've developed a tool for assessing leadership that I discovered there really was no way of, there was no established way of saying somebody is going to be a good leader or somebody who could be responsible for the lives of people and organizations. So I developed a 5-point checklist that includes empathy, self-awareness, trust, the ability to have critical thinking and self-discipline. And if you start with those five,
those are good traits.
They're good traits.
They are good traits. They seem like they would overlap.
Yeah.
Let's take a call from Bob. Bob, welcome to WGN. You have a question for Dr. Gorgashan.
Yes, thank you. I just wondered how narcissism fits into OCPD and what the potential is to lead to mental and or physical abuse of a partner.
And OCPD, someone's going to have to explain that one to me.
Do you mean obsessive compulsive personality disorder?
Oh, okay. OCD. Okay.
Yes.
Okay. Good question.
There's no particular overlap necessarily between obsessive compulsive disorders and narcissism. They're both in the classification of personality disorders, but they're quite different usually. The second part of your question, I'm sorry, was
can they be
was the physical potential of leading to physical and or mental abuse of a partner?
Well, in the case of, let's leave OCPD aside because it's an anxiety disorder personality disorder. It's really a different thing. A pathological narcissistic person can be abusive. They can harangue their partner. They can, because of the rage I mentioned, when they're humiliated or injured, they can lash out. And that depends on their, not so much their narcissism, but other aspects of their personality. How much self-regulation do they have? But they can get awfully mean and attacking.
So the narcissism isn't necessarily a part of OCPD?
No, I wouldn't say they're connected to each other.
Thanks for the call, Bob. Appreciate it.
Okay.
Appreciate it. Let's go to, hi, who's this? Is this Karen?
Yeah, it is.
What a great name. Of course, I would say that in my narcissistic sense.
It's all about you.
It's all about me. Karen's. Everybody's named Karen tonight.
Yeah.
What is your question for Dr. Gorgashan?
Well, I have a question regarding a person who has that narcissism that is unhealthy.
Yeah.
I had a family member that I think was kind of under the thumb somewhat of in a daily situation having to be involved with someone who was like that. And does that type of personality tend to want to put down someone who is strong as opposed to someone who they find might be weak? Because that was the situation with this family member of mine. They were a very strong, confident person and extremely bright. And this person who had you'd say dominion or was over them, just zeroed in on them of all the other people they could have, and they would seek to constantly harass.
okay,
this
so,
person in my family. So I just wondered, was it because my family member was strong and they felt threatened by them?
Dr. Gorbachev?
Okay, well, it's hard to say what was going on in their mind.
Yeah.
But again, the narcissistic person is going to lash out at anyone who makes them feel humiliated or weak, and they may be, some are controlling and demand loyalty and get furious with anybody who challenges their authority or shows any sign of not thinking they are the greatest. So your family member may have fallen into that situation.
Do we have time for one more, Cash? Is that a yes? Okay. Dave, welcome to WGN. Can you ask your question very quickly for Dr. Gorgachev?
Yes. I'm wondering if you see more narcissistic personality patterns in the youth of today.
Ah, good question.
Yeah.
I had that same question.
Because they have such instant gratification in the high-tech, high cyber world that they live in, what they're being exposed to?
Well, you asked one of my favorite questions, because I am a great defender of the youth of today. I think they're terrific, and I don't think they're any more narcissistic than my generation or all the generations in between. This has been around for a long time, since the dawn of human history. Narcissism, the name comes from Greek mythology, so
sure,
it's nothing new. I see a lot of committed...
Some of the...
Go ahead.
I see a lot of committed, active, vital youth. So I think all of us need to look at ourselves and say, what are we doing to bring ourselves into the community, and what can we do to remember there are other people around? And it's not a generational thing. It's something all humans have to struggle with.
I have 2 seconds, but I know you're writing a book called Starting Older. Can
yes.
you give it like a 10-second review of what it's about?
There's a new life stage because people are living longer, so 65-year-olds have a chance, 65-year-olds have a chance to reinvent themselves, and I'm writing a book about it.
Sounds great. And if anyone wants to contact you for some guidance and help and those kinds of things, or any other issues in the workplace, where can we reach you?
Probably the best thing is to go to my website, where all my contact information is, Invantage Advising, INVANTAGE, advising.com.
Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Take care.
In 10 years, we're going to have 1 million lawyers, 1 million lawyers, 1 million lawyers. In 10 years, we're going to have 1 million lawyers. How much can a poor nation stand? Everybody now. In 10 years, we're going
to have... Oh, everyone's nightmare. 1 million lawyers. You know, we're not so bad. You know, we help you out when you have problems. Everyone hates a lawyer until you need a lawyer. Then you call me and you say, Karen, can you help me? Can you point me in the right direction? And that's what we're going to do now. It's 8 o'clock, a little after 8 o'clock, and this is the time that we reserve mostly for your calls. So give me a call here. You can use your real name or a fake name. You call yourself Karen in the narcissistic sense, and you can ask me any question you have, and I'll try to give you an answer. Now, I don't know everything about everything, but hopefully I'll be able to explain at least how you're going to find the right answer to your question or a resource for you. And I'm always happy. I'm going to give out the numbers here, 312-981-7200. Write that down, 312-981-7200. Text to that same number. And if for some reason you don't get your call heard or you want a more private venue, you can always call me at my office. And that number is 312-332-7800, or better yet, email me at wgn@askkarenconti.com. Let us go to Tom. Welcome to WGN. This is the Karen Conti Show. Hi, Tom.
Hi, Karen. How are you?
Good.
Good. So my question is, I had a contract to do some work in my house and in the kitchen, and we had to have it redone. Like the tile was real uneven where you would trip. So I had it redone, and I've got every pictures and everything to go to small claims court. I want to get about $9,000. My concern is other people I've talked to, everybody seems to be of the opinion, yeah, I'll go and win that, but I'll never collect a penny from him.
Tom,
so,
that's, yeah. Here's my thought on this. $9,000 is a lot of money. I'd bend over and pick it up if I dropped it. But there is a lot of work involved in bringing a lawsuit on your own. It's one thing to hire a lawyer, but you'd pay a lawyer. It certainly wouldn't be worth paying a lawyer for $9,000. But if you're inclined, you know, a lot of people get very nervous going to court, and it's very technical because you have to fill out certain paperwork, and you have to do it correctly, and you have to be in court, and you have to park at the courthouse, and you have to be there on time, and you have to follow the rules, even though it's pretty user-friendly. In small claims court business, it's for people who don't have lawyers. But your friend is right that once you get a judgment, let's just say you bring it to court, he breached the contract, he was negligent in doing this work, here are the pictures, here's the money that I had to spend to have it done correctly. And the judge says, yes, Tom, I'm going to enter judgment against ABC Construction Company in the amount of $9,000. Then begins the odyssey of collecting. And then, you know, here, let me ask you this question. Is the company, and I don't want you to mention the name, but is the company a big company or small company?
Small company.
And do you know if they have a business address, or are they kind of a guy who works out of his garage kind of thing?
No, they have a business address, and it is an LLC.
Okay. And that means that they probably that the owners are protected from the company's misconduct. So again, you know, this is something that if you feel strongly that you want to get a judgment against them and that you want to try to collect, go ahead and do it. But collection would entail putting a lien on property that you know that that company owns. It would entail garnishing bank accounts, which means if you know where their bank accounts are, you would be able to put a block on their bank account and go back to court and collect it. The other part of this is perhaps you could find a collection lawyer who would take this on a contingency, meaning you take your judgment against this company and the lawyer would take it and take probably a third of whatever the lawyer recovered. Again, though, because it's a small amount, a lot of lawyers don't want to take on that kind of responsibility for such a small amount of money. So that said, you know, that's a decision that you're going to have to make. I hope that helped.
Okay.
Is that all right?
Yeah, it is.
Okay.
Yeah, thank you very much.
All right, good luck.
Okay.
Good luck. That's, you know, it's a hard thing. You don't want to let them go because you hired someone, they didn't do their job. But on the other hand, you don't want to throw your time away by going after a company that's maybe insulated or maybe doesn't have any assets to speak of. Let me get up the numbers again. It's Karen Conti Show and WGN. I'm taking your legal questions. I'm a practicing lawyer. And if you have any questions about anything, contract law, criminal law, anything you've read in the paper, let us know, and I'll try to give you the right answer. 312-981-7200 or text at that same number. Hi, Patrick. Welcome to WGN.
Good evening, Karen. How are you?
Good. Thank you.
I inherited a piece of property in the city of Chicago from my late uncle. He had rented a spot in his garage to somebody who then just skipped out of town, left the car there. It's at least 20 years old. I don't know who owns it. How can I get rid of it?
Okay. Do you know where that person is by any chance?
No.
Okay.
No.
You don't have a last known address for that person other than what your uncle had?
I couldn't locate anything in the house indicating who it was.
And do you have any idea from the car itself as far as title or anything that would help you in the right direction of where this person is?
It has a VIN and it has a license plate, but it's the old, old Illinois license plates.
So that doesn't help you get to where you're going.
Exactly.
Well, you know, in that case, I would think that you had the right to have it towed out of there. Is it probably has some value, correct?
Not from when I look at it.
Okay.
And it looks like it had been in a car accident, so I kind of wonder whether or not the owner of the vehicle stashed it after a hit and run.
Oh, my goodness. Well, you know, I think that you are free to dispose of it as you see fit, whether that's to call one of these charities to have them tow it out for parts or just have someone pick it up. Generally speaking, if someone leaves something with you, there is a certain time period where you want to leave it so that they could come back and retrieve it. But here it's been there for a long time. You have no forwarding address. You have no way of trying to find this person, so I think you're free to get rid of it as you see fit.
Even without a title?
if you don't have a title, I mean, you should probably just call a service and see what they say about that. I don't know, maybe a towing service and a junkyard will say we're not going to do that unless you have a title. So I don't know.
I think Dean Richards voices over a commercial about that.
Yes, I think you're right about that. Good luck. If you have any other questions, though, and if I can help you further, give me an email, because there are some people who I know that do this kind of work, generally speaking, that might have a little bit more insight on how to get a title if that's necessary to get rid of the car. And you can email me at WGN@AskKarenConti.com. Thanks, Patrick.
Thank you very much.
Have a good night. All right, 981-7200, 312-981-7200. Taking your calls, our phone lines are open. You're listening to the Karen Conti Show on WGN. Oh, that made me hungry. Oh, yes, that made me hungry. Who doesn't like the taste of chocolate? You're listening to WGN, and you're listening to the Karen Conti Show, and we are at the point in the show where I take your legal calls on any legal topic, 312-981-7200. And again, let me give out my phone number at the office in case you'd like to reach me there. It's always best to give me an email where you can give me a few facts, maybe the county where it happened, the date on which the problem occurred, and what you're looking for, so I know what I'm dealing with, and I can give you a quick email back. And that's WGN@AskKarenConti.com. That's KarenConti. Or you can call me at 312-332-7800. All right, let's go to the lines. Chris, welcome to WGN. Hi, Chris.
Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't know I was on. Hi,
how are
you?
You are on.
Oh, okay. I'm just, I have a question.
Sure.
And with all this left-wing accusations that keep coming out against Trump, can there come a point where they can actually sue these media moguls?
Okay, that's a good...
Do you know what I'm saying? Maybe I could present it better, but that was my point. Like, something's got to make them stop. I mean, can they start slapping lawsuits when they find out that these reports they're actually putting on major news stations are false?
Okay, that's a good question. Let me just talk about the law of defamation, because, well, actually, one of the things that I've heard bantered about is that, and I think maybe our president was in favor of somehow loosening the defamation laws to make it easier for people to sue for defamation. First of all, it's very difficult to sue for defamation, and the reason why is because we love our First Amendment. And I'm not going to get on a soapbox, but maybe I will. Just as an aside, I was just with my husband. We took a long trip to Vietnam and Cambodia, among other places, and they don't have freedom of speech there. Their internet is very much monitored. The tour guides wouldn't answer our questions unless we were in private because they feared retribution. And when I say retribution, I mean families would disappear. Not only would they disappear, but family members would disappear because they were speaking out against the government or criticizing the government. So please understand that in this country, that First Amendment is one of the best things we have. It keeps us in a situation where we can criticize our government and criticize the players so that we can continue to have, you know, the freedoms that we have. That said, when you are in a public office and when you are a public personality, it is very difficult to bring a lawsuit and sustain it in the area of defamation. So let's just say that this is about Donald Trump and there are false reports that he had an affair with a stripper. Let's just say that is completely and totally false. He is a public person, so he would have to show, he would have to bring a lawsuit against whatever media outlet, and he would have to say that the media outlet knew or should have known and that this was false, that it was a false statement of fact, and that he suffered damage because of it. And they would have to show what we call actual malice, which is that you are held to a higher standard because when you are a public person, you put yourself in the spotlight, and therefore people are going to talk about you, whether that means you're a celebrity, that means you're a politician, or anybody who enjoys that kind of celebrity or that kind of notoriety. And so it makes it hard because people will talk about you and people will say false things. And in particular, our politicians, it has become very common, and maybe it's offensive to many of you that things are said that are fake news and things that are said with no basis whatsoever. It's been done to Donald Trump. It's been done to President Obama. It's been done to Hillary Clinton. It's been done to everybody. And we see a lot of that. But the bottom line is, should the government politicians, should they all be filing lawsuits against media outlets? Is that a good use of our time? Is that a good use of our energy when we have other things going on? The answer, in my opinion, would be no. How do the news outlets get held accountable otherwise? Well, I think that people should be very careful in what they listen to and what they watch. And if they see something on the media that's false or it turns out to be false, I think there should be a campaign of writing and emailing to the news outlets to say, I'm not listening to CNN. I'm not watching Fox anymore if you're going to put out things that are false. And that's the way the media should be regulated. But the media has an obligation to look at these stories, and they have an obligation to vet them. And if you don't like the story, you still should listen to it, and you should still come up with your own solution as to whether or not it's something that's true or not true. But thank you for the call. I think it's something that we should be talking about, and it's a very good topic. 312-981-7200. On the topic of what's going on in the news with Donald Trump, I have heard over and over again that Mueller, the investigator, might be looking into charges of obstruction of justice. And one of the things, I'm not going to opine about whether or not there has been obstruction of justice, because we don't know. We don't know what the facts are. We don't know exactly what he's investigating or what the scope of his investigation is going to be. But I want to talk about obstruction of justice, so that you guys all know exactly what it is, and so when your friends start spouting off things, you can correct them. I'm going to read just parts of what the definition is. It's a person who commits obstruction of justice when they knowingly alter, destroy, mutilate, conceal, cover up, falsify, with the intent to impede, obstruct, or influence the investigation or administration within the jurisdiction of the United States. And that's essentially what it is. So let's just boil that down. What does that mean? Usually it means that it's lying to investigators about something. It means that you alter or destroy evidence. And it can also be obstruction by people who are in governmental positions like judges, prosecutors, attorneys, even police officers, elected officials who are doing something to impede an investigation that's in process. Okay? Some of the examples that we have in our recent history, Bill Clinton was impeached for obstruction charges based upon the fact that he lied about his relationship with Monica Lewinsky in a deposition in that Paula Jones case. The Paula Jones case was a sexual harassment case relating to conduct before he was president. It was determined that he lied under oath, and that was obstruction of justice because he was standing in the way of the truth of that lawsuit. Richard Nixon, of course, was being investigated for obstruction of justice for his role in the Watergate affair. Vice President Scooter Libby was convicted of obstruction of justice. He was later pardoned by George. His sentence was commuted by George Bush. And then if you remember, Barry Bonds was convicted of obstruction of justice in 2011 for his testimony in front of the grand jury. He was called upon to testify about his use of steroids, and he said some things that wasn't really perjury. They didn't charge him with perjury. They charged him with obstruction because they thought he was being evasive. Later, the conviction was overturned by an appellate court, but he was convicted of obstruction of justice. So you see that obstruction has a bunch of different elements to it. And when we see what Mueller's doing, we have to go to the issue of what, if anything, did President Trump do to obstruct justice? Is firing somebody who's investigating you obstruction? I don't know. Is trying to convince a government official to go easy on one of your appointees? I don't know if that's obstruction of justice. That's something that we're going to have to see if Mueller brings those charges or states that that those things happen. One of the things I'm going to say before I take a break is that the interesting part is going to be if President Trump does cooperate and talk to Mueller, because he's a person who is hard to control. He's very headstrong. His lawyers are going to have a hard job of controlling him, and lying to an investigator in that realm, even that in and of itself, could be obstruction if he doesn't tell the honest truth. So it's going to be interesting. I just wanted to make sure that everyone understands what that crime really is and how serious it is. You're listening to the Karen Conti Show. Please give us a call. We got open phone lines for your legal questions, 312-981-7200, and we are on WGN.
On this side of the law, on that side of the law, who is right, who is wrong, who is for and who's against the law? Well, you see, I didn't really mean you any harm.
Welcome back to the Karen Conti Show on WGN. This is the point where we take legal calls, but no one's calling. Call in. The lines are open. This is your chance to get a little bit of free legal advice. The number is 312-981-7200, 312-981-7200. You know, I was looking ahead of at the week, and I see that it's going to be Groundhog Day on Friday, and you know, again, if he does see his shadow, we have the 6 weeks of winter. One of the things that's interesting about Groundhog Day is that it dates back to the ancient Christian celebration of called Candlemas Day. Candlemas Day is the 40th day following the birth of Jesus and is celebrated by the presentation of the baby Jesus to the temple. And I guess some immigrant Germans in Pennsylvania started celebrating that when they came to the United States in the 1800s, and that's where Groundhog Day derived from. I thought that was very, very, very interesting. And anyway, I guess the other thing that's interesting is that during Prohibition, the groundhog apparently officially threatened that if he wasn't allowed to have a drink, he would have 60 more weeks of winter. That's the truth. So I don't know. I don't know if there was 60 more weeks of winter. But that groundhog is a very powerful guy, because I would like to see spring very time soon. Let's talk about my favorite topic, which is my section of the show called Presumed Ignorant. We have three really good presumed ignorant criminals this week. One coming out of Sun City, Arizona. A Sun City man reported that his girl threatened him with a bayonet because of bad soup. Bad soup. He argued with his girlfriend because the soup she made was really bad, and he supposedly she brought out a bayonet and threatened him. The second one is another one involving food. It seems like food is a common theme when it comes to anger these days. Maybe it's the idea that we're in the middle of the winter and there needs to be comfort food. This one comes out of Moundville, Alabama. A man is facing domestic violence charges after a disagreement with his brother over, you guessed it, a piece of cheesecake. According to court records, the older brother, who was 24, was still holding the butcher knife he had used to cut the dessert when they began arguing about portion size. And so the older brother was charged with third-degree domestic violence and harassment. Interesting. And my final and favorite one is an accused heroin dealer in upstate New York is going to court, and he's being forced to wear a spit shield at the defendant's table because he has a history of spitting on his attorneys. Here's a guy. Really? You want to spit on your attorney when they're trying to help you and save your life? Really? Brooklyn native Tyson Polis was ordered to don a Hannibal Lecter type headgear. There's a picture of it if you go online. And after he revealed a plan for actually spitting at the judge, so he was upping the ante a little bit here. Anyway, he did it again. He did it back in 2014, according to his attorney. He had hepatitis, and so no one wants to take any chances of him spitting. Those are my presumed ignorant of the week. Here we got some calls, 312-981-7200. Let's go to the lines. Diane. Hi, Diane. Welcome to the Karen Conti Show.
Hi, Karen. I have a legal question for you.
Sure.
We are in DuPage County. We own a home. House next door is rented out. The renters put their boat and a bunch of garbage against our fence that we had installed a few years ago, wooden stockade, 6-foot panel fence. the fence is broken and leaned in. So when they can't, while the renters were there, we asked them, you know, what are you going to do about this? Oh, I'll take care of it. I'll take care of it. Okay, they never did. They got evicted. So we went to the owners of the property and said, you know what? Your renters broke our fence. Oh, send us pictures. We'll send it in to our insurance. So I sent them pictures through the email. They gave me their email address. Didn't hear anything. I went down to the owners. They have a business here. And I said, you know, did you get the pictures? No, we didn't. Can you send them again? So I sent them again. They ignored me, didn't write back. I saw her driving down the street one day. I said, what's up? You know, what are you going to do with the fence? Oh, I never got your pictures. So I'm frustrated now.
Okay, let me ask you, Diane, how much is, did you get some estimates on what it would cost to repair?
No, because my sons and my husband put the panels in.
Okay.
So, you know, we just bought them at Home Depot and put them in ourselves, but it was a nice fence and they did a great job, but it's all ruined now.
Okay. So, well, you know, at this point in time, you know, I think you can sign one more letter and you can say, listen, I'm going to hire an attorney unless you take care of this. Here's what we're demanding, and you might want to come up with an amount of money so you can say X amount of dollars, whether it's $500, whatever it is that you think compensates you. That would include the maybe the cost of your husband's labor. You know, you could put a price on it as whatever dollars per hour. And, of course, your materials that you use to repair it. And if there's anything that's still not looking right, maybe an extra few dollars because it's now looking a little bit, you know, different than it did before. And then, you know, how much do you think it would cost altogether to fix it? What do you think? Are we talking about a $500? Are you talking about $2,000?
I'd say between $500 and $1,000, probably.
Okay.
There's probably 8 panels of 6-foot fencing, and now new posts have to be put in because they leaned their boat against it. And also, I did take videos and photos of their boat when the renter was there leaning, so I do have the photos.
So here's
and
the
went. Yeah.
Okay, so I think generally speaking, this might be even under their deductible, so they're probably saying to themselves, if these people go away, if I take on this claim, I'm going to have to pay the first $500 or $1,000, which is a standard homeowner's deductible, and so I'm just going to make them be frustrated. Maybe they're just flaky. So I think you have to have a stern letter, and I'm not saying a phone call, I'm saying a letter. Dear Mr. and Mrs. Smith, this is my fifth attempt to get you to pay for this. If not, I'm going to bring a small claims, or I'm going to have a lawyer write a letter. And, you know, maybe what we do is, just for purposes of the show, if that doesn't work, why don't you send me an email at my email address, and I'll send a letter to them and see if I can get that taken care of. We'll see if that works, okay?
So oh, you're wonderful. You're fabulous.
My email address is WGN at AskKarenConti.com. That's K-A-R-E-N. C-O-N-T-I. And for others who don't email or want to call, it's 312-332-7800. But that's really the only way, Diane, to make them do what the right thing is. Okay?
Fabulous. Thank you.
All right. Good luck. All right. Let's go to Dom. Welcome to WGN. Hi.
Hi there, Karen. How are you?
Good. What's your legal problem?
Okay. My dad had an irrevocable living trust, okay?
Okay.
And he passed away, and there's three of us, two sisters and myself, and the one said, you know, we're going to get a handsome amount of money three ways. But then, on the side of it, he also had a checking account, which wasn't in the trust, and my sister said, because it was in joint tenancy, you know, through the bank?
Yes.
That was legally hers. But now she's changed her mind and says she wants to split it. If she doesn't consider that in the trust, does that have to go through probate and everything else?
First of all, I don't practice in this area, so I'm going to qualify everything I'm saying. And I also haven't looked at the complete estate plan, so I haven't read these documents. I'm going to give you what I do know about this. If the account was in the name of your father and your sister in joint tenancy, that would go to her automatically, okay? It doesn't go through probate. If it's not in the trust specifically, it actually... it belongs to her when your father dies, if it's a right of survivorship or if it's a joint checking account. So a joint checking account, if you and I Dom had a joint checking account, I could go in and take all the money, and so could you. So you don't need a second signatory. So she, technically, that amount should be hers. So she doesn't have to give it back to the estate. But if she does, you know, and I don't think you would have to open up a probate estate just for the purposes of that checking account. It would probably be that you would take the trust document, and you would take the language of the trust, you divide everything up, whatever needs to be sold gets sold, whatever is liquidated, and the proceeds divided. Probably that was what your dad's trust said. So, no, you wouldn't have to open up an account just for that bank account.
No, I mean, you're right, because she's on the checking account with my dad, and it's really a handsome amount. I mean, it's hundreds of thousands, so
oh.
She thinks it's all hers.
Okay.
So,
well, and but if the account is in her name and your dad's name and he passes away, that account goes to her, and that does not
okay.
go through the probate estate, and that doesn't get included as, you know, her half and her share or anything like that. So if you know, just for everybody out there, if you have somebody on your bank account when you die, that will automatically go to that person. Okay?
Okay.
All right.
If you
have any
much.
Other questions, give me a call, and I can maybe refer you to an estate planning lawyer and, you know, if you need anything further help on that. All right?
All right.
All right. More calls. We've got time. We've got 15 minutes left. 981-7200, 312-981-7200, or text to that number. You're listening to The Karen Conti Show on WGN. Here on WGN, I'm taking legal calls. Call us here, 312-981-7200, 981-7200. If you don't get through and you'd like to email me privately or call me privately, call at 312-332-7800, or better yet, email me at WGN@AskKarenConti.com. Jim, welcome to the show. How are you?
Yeah, hi, Karen. I have two neighbor-type questions, and I'm just wondering if I have any rights as far as either one of them. One of them's kind of strange. Not my backyard neighbor, but one over has a tree in the back property line of their lot, sort of dead center. And it has arced up over my neighbor's yard and now down into my yard to the point where the branch is actually cutting through branches of a tree that I've got in my yard. And I'm just wondering, can I go to this neighbor and do they have to cut that back, or is it just my problem?
Generally speaking, you own your property all the way on up. Okay, from the ground on up. That's what the law essentially says. So you have a right to trim that tree to the extent it's on your property. Obviously, there are problems sometimes with trimming trees that when you do it in the wrong way, or you may do it in an excessive way, that tree may grow out not looking so great, or might actually injure the health of the tree. But
no, that would not be the case.
But you have a right to do that. Now, do you have do they have an obligation to trim the tree is the next question. You know, and that's a tough one, and I don't know how that one would come down. But certainly the easiest way to do it without causing problems with your neighbor would be to say to the neighbor, listen, I maybe ask them to trim it. And they'll say no. They say yes. That'd be, you know, we take it one way or the other. If they say no, then you say, well, I have talked to a lawyer, and I'm going to trim it, you know, just to the extent it's on my property. And then you make sure that when you call the tree trimmers that they only trim from where your property begins and where your property ends. So that, and again, this is difficult because your other neighbor, it sounds like, also is being encroached. And if you will this affect their property at all, or just yours?
Well, it arcs up, so it's kind of high over their property. There's no issue there.
Okay. So it's coming down on yours. So that's my best advice there on what to do. Okay.
Now, if I do that and say it costs me $150, can I expect to be reimbursed, or that's just my out-of-pocket cost?
That's probably your out-of-pocket cost. I don't know that the neighbor has an obligation to trim their tree to the extent it's infringing on your property, unless it's damaging something. And then when I say damaging, if it's like falling onto your garage or something like that. But that's my best advice. And, you know, the other thing that with these neighbor disputes that I've dealt with for years, you want to try to do it. Legally, you have rights and obligations, but you want to do this in a way that doesn't destroy relationships, because even though this might not be a next-door neighbor, you know, you're going to be known in the neighborhood as someone who's, you know, a troublemaker, and you want peace. You don't want to walk into your house every day and have an argument with people. You really don't, because I know a lot of people who have moved out because they've had just these kinds of issues over fences, over noise, over lights, over all kinds of things that they're not petty, but in the grand scheme of your house and your ownership and your enjoyment, you don't want to mess with it unless you have to. This is my best advice.
You're right. It's a minor thing. Yeah, the other thing is the next-door neighbor on the other side, when I moved in, they parked an old truck with an old small house trailer behind it. And they've lived there now about 8 years. The darn thing has never been driven, never been moved. It's a real eyesore. There's squirrels running all over the top of the trailer. And the vehicle has 1999 Arizona plates on it. And apparently, since I'm an unincorporated McHenry County and the county rules, does he have the right that he can just sit this vehicle here and it be just an eyesore right next to the property line?
Well, Jim, I'm going to put you on hold and answer your question. The answer to your question is I don't know. I would have to know exactly what the rules are in unincorporated McHenry, because sometimes there are rules that are very specific that says you can't park certain vehicles for a certain length of time, and there's certain blight control issues, but not knowing the law there and not knowing exactly where you are, I would make sure you research that, go to the village, go to whatever ordinances there are and see what your rights are. And again, be careful, because, you know, you could report that neighbor and have them come over and take it away or fine them or something. But you might want to just ask them before you do it. That would be my best advice to you. Okay, here we go. Some more legal questions, 981-7200. Let's go to Ron. Welcome to WGN and welcome to the Karen Conti Show.
Okay, thank you very much.
What is your legal question?
My question is, my wife and I, we had a 2004 Focus, and right from the first week that we had problems with the transmission with it, and we kept taking it into the dealer. It was a reputable dealer, and they would fix it. And what the car was doing, sometimes the car wouldn't go into reverse. We were on the expressway. The car died out, and we brought it back in, and we told them that the transmission is bad. You need to repair it. So we contacted Ford.
Okay, so I just want to cut to the chase here. You're not getting any help with the Ford. You're not getting help with the where you bought it, correct? And your question is, do you have a right to get a new car, or do you have a right to make a claim?
Well, what happened was, we were on the expressway, one night, and, the engine and transmission both blew up on it. We had it towed back, and, we called the, finance company, told them what happened, and we had the car picked up.
Okay, I'm going to have to cut you short because I got a bunch of callers here. So here's my best advice to you. there's lemon laws in Illinois. There are lawyers who do this. If you email me, I can refer you to a lawyer who does just this kind of work. And there's certain rules about how you bring these law violations. It has to be a certain number of problems with the car over a certain period of time, and it has to be serious problems with the car. It sounds like you might qualify as a lemon law case. So I think the best way to do this is to give me a call or email me, and I will refer you to a person who knows exactly how to make this claim if you're not getting taken care of in the right way. And I'm going to give you that number. My number is 312-332-7800, but in this case, I would really like an email so I can quickly give you that lemon law referral, and that's WGN@AskKarenConti.com. Yeah, those are, Lemon Law is very specific, but if you win those cases, a lot of lawyers take those cases because they get attorney's fees and other kinds of awards if the company doesn't do right. Let's go to Rick. Welcome to WGN. This is Karen Conti.
Hi.
Hi.
I got a quick question.
Yes.
My father-in-law passed away about a year and a half ago, and my sister-in-law was the executor of the will, and she hasn't shown the will to anybody. And so everything was paid out, supposedly, and nobody ever even got to see what the will stated. Do we have a legal right, I'm assuming, to see the will?
And you sure it was a will and not a trust? Do you know, you don't even know that, probably, right?
I'm not 100% sure, but I'm pretty sure it was a will.
Rick, this is one of the hardest things in estate planning because, you know, let's just say that there was a trust, and the trust is something that gets done without the court getting involved, without probate. And if she was the executor of the trust and she was the one who was responsible for basically gathering the assets and then paying the debts and then giving the money out to the beneficiaries, then, you know, you may not have a right to get a copy of this. I assume you've asked her for a copy, correct?
Yes.
And she said no, which makes you believe that maybe she's done something wrong, correct?
Exactly.
The only way to really do this is to hire a lawyer and have the lawyer file something, either make a demand on her first, that's what a lawyer would probably do, to say, hey, listen, you know, we need to see this because we're just concerned that there something was done that was incorrect. And any person who is above board would probably just turn it over and say, yeah, this is what I did. I did what my father wanted to do. If that didn't happen, then your lawyer needs to move quickly and file something in court in order to get her to come to court and show where the money went and what the will said. Okay, so that's probably your best advice. If you need a referral, I can give you a referral for someone that does that, but please be advised that you're going to need to pay a lawyer up front to handle this, okay? So there has to be enough.
Is there a time limit involved?
I really don't know exactly. You know, here, I don't know. No, I don't know the time limit exactly, and it depends on a lot of things, and I'm not an estate planning lawyer. But I would say you should move quickly because let's just say that she went and spent that money. Then you're going to have a problem collecting it. So
again, she already has.
Yeah.
But I just want to know if my wife is upset for no reason or not, you know? Just
yes. Well, give me an email, and I'll send you to somebody who's got a little more expertise in that area. Okay? Good luck to you. Thank you for listening. I want to thank my wonderful producer, Cash. I want to thank Dr. Prudence Gorgachon and Megan Lernan from the Lurie Children's Hospital. You're listening to WGN.